New York area listeners, just a reminder, Andrew Talks to Chefs is doing our first live show at the Brooklyn Podcast Festival. Join us at the Bell House in the Gowanus neighborhood of Brooklyn on Saturday, January 12th at 2:30 p.m. with special guests Tom Colicchio, Greg Backstrom, Alex Raj, and Alan Harding, plus a live performance of our theme music and other songs by the Brooklyn-based band Fathers. Tickets are $15, but with the promo code Andrew, they are yours for just $10. Visit ATTC, that's short for Andrew Talks to Chefs, attcbkpodfest.eventbrite.com, or if that's too long to remember, visit the event page on my blog, tokeland.com/appearances. Hope to see you there.
Today's program is brought to you by 100 Bogart Street, a co-working and event space in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Learn more at 100bogart.com.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
All the time I go out and you have not a great day on the water, or it's rough, or it's wet, or it's rainy, and I think, wow, is this really worth all the effort? Is this really... And then I think, what else would I do? What else could be close to, like... I mean, look at this. Just to be in any little boat and out there doing nothing. I mean, there's something that happens to people when they're on the water.
That is Chef Carrie Heffernan of Grand Banks Restaurant in New York City, our guest today on Andrew Talks to Chefs. It's gonna take a Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, and I am, as I'm sure you are, in the throes of holiday madness. I think we're all at full throttle at this point, and I think that's why today's guest and the location of today's interview might offer you all a little bit of a respite. This is an interview today with Chef Carrie Heffernan, recorded on a summery day in October on a boat in the Hudson River, in the New York Harbor, right off Lower Manhattan. The boat is now a restaurant. It has been converted to a restaurant. It has been a restaurant for 5 years. It is called Grand Banks. Carrie has been the chef emeritus there and sustainability director, which we'll explain in this interview, for four of its 5 years, and is also in those positions at a couple of sister restaurants of Grand Banks, one in Brooklyn, one in Governor's Island, New York, and also one down in New Orleans. This is all explained in the interview. And Carrie is, in addition to being a friend of mine, a veteran of the time that probably most excites me in American culinary history. It's the time I wrote about in my recent book. He's been in the cooking game since the 1970s. Came up in the 1980s working for people like David Boulay, the great chef in New York City. Spent time as an unknown cook with a fellow unknown cook back in those days by the name of Tom Colicchio, who's now still his good friend and fishing buddy. The two of them spent time staging or apprenticing in France back in the time that I'm talking about. And then Carrie came into his own as a chef. He's been the chef of a number of restaurants, 1 Fifth Avenue. He was actually the opening chef when it was still owned by Danny Meyer of 11 Madison Park, and a lot of restaurants in between and since then. I met with Carrie, like I said, in October, although it was an unseasonably warm day. We met at Grand Banks, so we were on the water. And during this interview, you can hear in the background everything from helicopters to boats to birds, to music that they were playing in the restaurant. It at various times sounds like Apocalypse Now and like a beach movie. But I think it's a very relaxing listen. I had a very transportive time editing it and hearing those sounds and remembering what it was like to be on that boat. And Carrie's a very calm dude. And I think you're going to really enjoy hearing from him. It's a wide-ranging interview, although not a terribly long one. I will let some of you know for whom this is a problem, although I think it's a minority of listeners. But Kerry, because he's so involved in the sustainability movement, has very strong opinions about politics, and that does come up briefly in this interview. If that's a problem for you, you might want to skip over that portion when you hear it coming, but I certainly wasn't going to edit it out. I should also mention that Kerry and I are occasional tennis nemeses. We occasionally take to the court, maybe twice a year. We touch on that very briefly in the interview, and I think that's all I need to say about it. So with all that, I'm going to ask you to imagine me and Kerry Heffernan sitting on deck on the boat that is now known as Graham Banks Restaurant on Lower Manhattan a few months ago in New York City. Here you go. We are sitting here on, it's an October afternoon technically.
This doesn't feel that way.
Feels like an August afternoon. You, first of all, walked up to meet me. And you were a vision of summer. You're in a white t-shirt. You're in khaki shorts. Wait, I got to look at your shoes.
Basically, yeah. Tennis shoes.
Tennis shoes, and that's all you need. It's like 80 degrees out here today.
Rode the city bike to get down here.
Oh, you do that?
Yeah.
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 It works for you.
City bike is actually an important part of my tennis game now because I need to work out and I need to have, you know, the glutes and the quads strengthened. You know, I mean If I don't have the wheels to get in position,
yes,
I can't make the shot.
100%.
I'm sloppy, I'm late, or whatever it is.
And it beats just going to the gym, hopping on a bike.
Yeah, I don't like the gym, and I don't like to run. So and the bike is, you know, it's a motivation. There's time. It gives you, you know, calories. It gives you distance. You can. I'm lucky enough to be able to do it up and down the bike path here on the West Side Highway, which is like safety, you know, times 10 compared to what it is on like 7th Avenue or whatever. I'm a fan.
All right. So let's orient. We're basically sitting in the Hudson River.
Right. Just at the mouth of New York Harbor.
We're down on, it's off Pier 25.
Correct.
And
Tribeca, Northmore Street.
So why don't you, first of all, how long is this restaurant? This is a seasonal restaurant.
Correct.
How many seasons now?
This is the fifth season.
Five already?
Yeah.
And you've been with it from the go?
No, for four.
For four?
Yeah.
Okay. And you guys have other, do you have one down south now?
So we have three other operations, three operations in total in New York and one in New Orleans. So we have Grand Banks here on Pier 25 in Tribeca.
Right.
We have Pilot in Brooklyn, which is Pier 6.
Yep.
Essentially where Atlantic Avenue meets Brooklyn Bridge Park.
Okay.
Different vessel, very similar vibe up top. It's a different Brooklyn kind of vibe, you know.
Yeah.
It's a little bit more mellow and a little more families, but it's great. I mean, I love Pilot.
Yeah.
And then we have Island Oyster, you know, which is on Governor's Island.
Yeah.
It's.
I didn't realize that was you guys.
Yeah. It's a 100-foot bar, which, you know, it's hard to visualize, but that's massive. I mean, this vessel is only 140 feet.
Yes.
So imagine 2/3 of it being just one long bar.
Yeah.
Looking at, you know, the southern tip of Manhattan.
Yeah.
And there on weekends, it can be absolute, you know, insanity. Very different vibe, very different kind of a restaurant. And then we have Seaworthy in New Orleans.
Got it.
And that's sort of adjacent to the Ace Hotel on Carondelet Street. So I don't know if you know the CBD or that neighborhood.
Not
but
really.
Yeah.
And but, you are what? You're the exec chef for all these joints?
Yeah, I'm kind of like the chef emeritus and sustainability director, you know. So really what I do is direct the menus and see what we can do to improve how sustainable we are, you know, especially in the fisheries.
Uh-huh. So this is, I don't know this much, that much about this part of your life, Kerry, but you are an avid fisherman.
Correct.
Can you just talk about that for a minute? It's because
we only have an hour.
Well, we only have an hour. It's interesting to me because your background, which we'll talk about, but you came up in some of the best restaurants in New York.
Thank you.
For some people, it might seem like a disconnect that you're doing what you do now, but this kind of, as I understand you from our time talking together over the years, this kind of fits very snugly into your personal passion, your personal rhythm, kind of like who you are.
Absolutely. You know, I've been lucky. I grew up in Rowayton, Connecticut.
Yes.
On the water.
For people who don't know, Rowayton is a, it's, I don't even know, how do you, it's amazing to me that people live there. I think of it as like a little mini Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah.
It does have a New England-y feel to it.
There's homemade ice cream joint. There's seaside fish houses.
None of which existed when I was there, and I did not take advantage of the proximity. I mean, I was just, as a bored kid, of course you're going to go clambering around the rocks and get in trouble on boats in the winter and boat yards, but I didn't really... I wish now I had that access that I did growing up.
Yeah.
But yeah, as it may, you know, I had that exposure then. We went to Cape Cod in the summer. So again, I was immersed in, you know, both the surf and the bay environments up there in Truro. And then I started working. And when you work, as you know, as a chef, you get what they call the vampire look. You become white. You're working, you know, 6 days, 12 hours a day. Or more white than I already am, I should say. And you
are extremely Caucasian.
Yes, absolutely. Irish and German all the way.
And from Connecticut.
And from Connecticut, exactly.
But you know, orient people. I don't want you to age. I don't want you to date yourself because you're so youthful looking. But no, but orient. You start cooking what year?
I started cooking in 1978.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is that amazing to hear yourself say that?
No. I would say it's actually, it would be 77 because I was 15. Yeah, so I'm 56 now. That was, you know, I had a couple of jobs in restaurants in Connecticut.
Yeah.
And then very quickly, you know, a bit of a tumultuous high school series of events, shall we say, that led to me going to vocational school, almost getting thrown out, graduating early, and then saying, I want to cook. And that was age 16.
Wow.
And at 17, I was commuting to the city from Connecticut, having graduated school.
Yeah.
And then knowing that I was going to go to the Culinary Institute of America, you know, and then that summer before I went, I took a bike trip at age 17 from May to September throughout Europe. Ended up working for 2 months in the south of France in a bakery.
Did you speak French?
A little bit, but I certainly learned. And the south.
So you had the food bug.
Had the food bug. I don't know anything else.
Yeah.
It's kind of like I fell into it, you know, through a series of hazards, which we've talked about.
Well, you know what, though, we have, and I don't want to press, so tell me if we don't go there. You seem, a lot of times I'll interview a chef or a cook, right? And they'll tell me, like, oh, and then there was this period of time in high school, you know, where I got in, you know, some scrapes or I got in some trouble. You tell me this, and like I look at you, you seem like such a gentle soul. It's hard for me to imagine the hooligan version of Carrie Heffernan.
More of the stoner, not going to class.
Oh, it's more of that kind
of
thing.
Yeah, less of the rabble rouser.
Okay, that makes more sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was my MO.
Got it. You had an aversion to formal education.
Homework and formal education, yeah.
Sitting still, all that good stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
But then... You know, the fast forward 3 years from there to when I started cooking school, I was
voracious.
I was avid. I wanted every bit of it. And the crazy thing is, I was the youngest kid in my class, and I already had in those days a lot more experience than the kids.
Yes.
So my glass was already half full. I could go right to the top very quickly. I could learn the good stuff and not be stuck learning the basics like a lot of the kids in my class were.
Right.
So I just ate it all up. I mean, I was in every class, every club, every activity. You know, I was all over it.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I was lucky. You know, I had the passion. I knew what I wanted to do.
Yeah. So who were some of the people you were? I mean, I know this obviously, but tell listeners who some of the people you worked for back in those days, and at what restaurants.
So I met David Boulay, who's very influential to me.
Yep.
When I worked in New York City the first time, when I was 17, I was at Le Périgord Park, which is 63rd and 3rd, which is now Vaucluse.
Mm-hmm. Michael White's place currently.
Michael White's place, exactly. And he was at Le Périgord on 52nd Street, which strangely has sort of come up in another conversation, but
yeah.
That's another day.
Yeah.
In any case, kept in touch with David, did my externship from school at a restaurant that he sort of helped me with.
He helped you get the job?
Yes, he did. I was working on weekends when he was at Vienna Park in Vienna 79. Yeah. So that's 1980.
A lot of people may not have heard of these 81. Restaurants, but David Boulay, who went on to be, I believe, the third American-born chef to ever get 4 stars from the Times in maybe 1990 when he had Boulay Restaurant, these are the early places where people started to notice him.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, where he got great reviews and built a reputation. Boulay, to me, as much as any chef of his generation, has the reputation of sort of... He has an artist's reputation. He's seen as...
100%.
He's seen as a little mercurial. He's seen as somebody who would not cut corners no matter what. There are people... Obviously, everyone loved that. I loved that restaurant until he closed it recently. But people will tell you back in the day, you might wait an hour between courses because it wasn't going to leave the kitchen until he said it was leaving the kitchen.
Yeah.
He would call new plays like in the middle of service and there'd be new things on the menu mid-service.
I think I've told you those stories.
You may have told me some of these, but these are common stories.
Yeah.
He can seem very distant when you talk to him, although I've always found him very polite and obviously brilliantly smart. What was he like young? What was he like pre-Four Stars? What was he like pre-dating Bernadette Peters? What was he like pre-cover of the New York Times Sunday Magazine? Was he like that or did he grow into that?
He grew into that, I have to say, because he... But the thing was, you could always tell he was always taking notes.
Mentally.
He was always observing. He was always registering. He was always... regurgitating things. Remember when we did this? Remember, you know, this I learned from, you know, Michel Gérard. This I saw at Trois Gros. And and he never forgets them. You know, I mean, we all see that stuff doing our stages.
Right.
But it may fall deeper into the recesses
things
of our
fade.
Mind.
Yeah.
It isn't. And he does not seem to forget it. And he processes it. And he makes it part of the vocabulary of what he's doing today.
He was imprinted by these things.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
And he...
You're born with that, right?
Yeah, I don't think... The gift David has is not something you could learn.
Yeah.
I don't think. And again, I've worked with many very, very powerful and influential figures. You know, Alfred Portale, Tom Colicchio, perhaps even more so. But David has a special place in terms of... the pure, and I use the term very, very discreetly, artist.
Yeah.
Because I think what we do is more of an artisan craft as opposed to artistic.
This is a running debate we have on the show.
Yeah, but
most chefs lean toward what you just said.
And I don't debate that. I think that what I do is an artisan. You know, there's times when artistry may fall off the spoon.
Yeah.
And I'm happy for it. But what David was and is, you know, is kind of a gifted artist. He understood things and put things together in ways that no one else does. And he takes inspiration, you know, from various, Robuchon certainly was one of his great mentors and all, many of the great places he worked.
And Verger was huge.
Absolutely.
But, you know, what I meant, though, was that he, I think I qualify it right. I said, as much as any chef, I think he had an artistic temperament or demeanor. In other words, maybe he's...
The mercurial wizard, alchemist.
And also in his own head.
Yeah.
It's very rare that, I don't know, I think a chef can only afford to be so much in their own head because you have to run a crew, right?
Yes.
You know?
Everyone
was like that.
He was like that, and that was perhaps, you know, one of his challenges, one of his downfalls, was not understanding... the other people don't work like him, and that businesses need to run, you know, on a bit more of a democratic is the wrong word, but in, you know, of a egalitarian basis.
It isn't
just this. Everyone is not as enamored with the changes in the smell of Cherville from yesterday to today, and they're not going to like. Stop everything to observe that, unfortunately.
Right. And account and adjust for it.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I'm talking about the stories. He would sit at the pass, and in those days, he was number one in Zagat for I don't know how many years running, but
for
at least.
Food.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we had these bus tubs that were filled with styrofoam cups. And there's like 40 styrofoam cups in a bus tub. And we had three bus tubs. So that's 120 different little tiny bases of shallots and red wine reductions and lobster glaze and any number of things, you know, that you'd find in any kitchen. But there was more in his palate.
Yeah.
And he'd sit there, you know, with his arms folded and put his left hand on his cheek and say, you know, Zagat had chives last week. You're like, fuck, what am I going to reinvent an onion to take the place of chives because he ate it last week and it has to be something different?
Right.
I mean, but that was the level of seriousness that he took into his craft and still does.
And I ate at that restaurant right at the very end, and it was still the food was insane.
It was magic.
So good.
Yeah.
So when you were a young cook and you see something like that, right? Was that inspirational? Was that intimidating? Because he had innate talent like very few people have.
Correct.
Right? How did that... Like, I almost think if I went into a kitchen as a young guy, one of my first jobs, and I was presented with that, I think I'm out of here.
Yeah,
I'll never be...
Mozart is your piano teacher.
And Salieri, right? Yeah. How did it affect you as a young man?
So I was inspired by it. I was certainly intimidated, but I knew enough that I would... You know, it's funny because I was thinking about this on the way down. Restaurants and services are a lot like tennis games. Like, so you win some and you lose some, and you have great ratings and whatever. But I rate the best games and the best services in restaurants as if, did I play my game? Was I able to bring what I know I can do and do the best I can and be happy with my performance? So I always knew... Mm-hmm. That I was not going to replicate what he does at that level. I never thought that I would have essentially the auberge in the city, which is what the original Boulet was.
Sure.
And I knew that I would do something different, and it would be I'm a bit more pragmatic to begin with.
Yep.
So I always knew that what I would do would be based in that.
Yeah.
So inspired, but understanding of where what I could do with it, okay. I guess is the best way to put it.
So you mentioned some of them. Just we don't need to take up all our time with other people.
Sure, but I'll leave
the background. Give a look. So you spent time working with Colicchio,
right?
At what restaurant?
So Tom and I met in the south of France in 1986.
Right. Yes.
When he had just, I don't know what, he was in between jobs, and we had the whole Montrachet incident had occurred with Drew, and I was sort of off staging, you know, and Ariane said, you go see my father, and there's a guy there from New Jersey, he's going to, maybe you help him, he doesn't speak French. So there was Tom, you know.
Now I have to interrupt for 1 second, because we're doing shorthand here. The Montrachet incident was when Boulet left, quote unquote,
right.
Montrachet, which was, Drew Nieport was the owner.
Right.
You were on the crew there.
Right.
Everybody left out of loyalty to David, the kitchen team.
Right.
And Ariane, who you just mentioned, is Ariane Degan, who is the co-founder of D'Artagnan.
Right.
And still is the...
Absolutely.
Still runs that thing. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you guys go... You're overseas and you run into... There was a guitar in this story. Am I remembering correctly? Very good memory.
So there's a guy, she said, from New Jersey who's going to be there, and you see if you can't help him out, because I'm not sure how well he's adapting to life in the countryside. And her father's restaurant in the middle of Auch, in the middle of Gascony, was, you know, remote and beautiful and some great food, but no one spoke English, and, you know, Tom was a little lost, and I came, and real hijinks did begin, I have to say. Lots of stories... Anyway, became fast friends. Both came back to New York. He started working for Thomas Keller. I started working for David Boulet.
Yeah.
And then our paths crossed again when he needed some help at Mondrian.
Mondrian was the first restaurant where he was the chef.
Right.
And that was they got 3 stars
right.
back when 3 stars was incredibly rare in New York City.
Correct.
When there were probably maybe a dozen places.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So you were part of that team.
Yes.
Okay.
And he started to fish then. And I fished with him a little bit. He was trout fishing. He was fly fishing for trout. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of fun. And then I started getting into fishing more and more. I'd have one day off. And in those days, you could rent a car for like $25. I'd go to Mamaroneck, where there was a boat rental, for like about $25. I'd fish all day in Mamaroneck. And then if I didn't do well enough... I'd drive the car to Sheepshead Bay and get on a party boat, which left at 5 o'clock and went till about 12 or 1 in the morning. So it just went sort of out of control there.
Yeah.
And it hasn't really changed much since. So a lot of the fishing that I do is much more saltwater. And I've seen this sort of ebb and flow of abundance, from... bluefish to striped bass to, you know, tuna fish in particular.
Yeah.
Seeing the decline after, say, 2006, 2006 class of fish to 2010, and just seeing this, like, drop off in striped bass really made me start to think a lot about what we were doing and how we were treating the ocean and how we're treating even our local waters.
Yeah.
In that time, we got a place in Sag Harbor, and we would grow oysters on the water at the end of our dock. So
you personally got a place in Sag Harbor.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that really gives you an insight into really being a steward of your environment, because you see firsthand, you work pretty hard at scrubbing these things and taking these cages in and out. And when you have, you know, 60-70% mortality due to, you know, worsening water quality and the increase of nitrogen, and it's disheartening.
Yeah.
You look at the big picture, you know, what would those homes be worth if all that water were, you know, putrid and full of dying fish, which is a real possibility still, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the roundabout way that I got into sustainability, was not being able to find the fish that I wanted to catch.
Yeah.
Seeing firsthand the degradation of an environment over a very short period. I'm talking 2 and 3 years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that, there's all sorts of environmental factors that change every year. So not every harvest of scallops or clams or any species of finfish is the same. But when you see it consistently across the board and you see the impacts, and this is very locally. I mean, I'm trying to tackle in one scenario just nitrogen in the water. I'm not looking at, you know, salinity, acidification, warming temperatures, because that's big picture stuff.
Now, you say tackle, what do you mean?
So I work with, this is kind of the other phase of what I do that I think you were talking about. So
I didn't even know, by the way, that this was your other hat here.
Yeah, yeah. So this particular group is group for the East End. And what they look at is water quality in the East End of Long Island. Very simple, very, very focused metric. And there's too much nitrogen, and there's ways around it. But it does become very quickly political.
Yeah.
I don't know how much politics you talk on your show.
I have no aversion to politics.
Okay.
For better and for worse, I've made my feelings known about certain things in the last 6 months. But go ahead. Whatever you want to say is fine.
My feelings are strong.
I fear nothing.
It is. There is really no question, if you look at the records, of which party would be beneficial to creating an environment for your children. I'll put it as simply as that.
Yeah.
And the disregard on one side for not only environmental issues but also regulations is blatant, and the arguments for it are ridiculous and basically couched in the interest of a few commercial groups, and it's pretty sickening to me personally, because I see this as a resource that should be shared. I mean, it isn't something that one party owns or one group of people own.
But I have a question for you. You asked me about politics, right?
Yeah.
Like, you don't know how I am about talking politics. I don't have 4 restaurants that I'm affiliated with, right? Does this ever bite you in the ass?
That's a good question. That's a good question.
Do people ever send you emails like, hey, you know what? I heard you on that thing, and I don't really care what you think. And
well, I've never gone on radio to talk about it.
Okay.
So I guess we'll find out.
We were talking about Colicchio a minute ago. He constantly he's very out there with his politics, which I admire because he has, you know, television and all this stuff. But constantly people are like, you know, why don't you just, you
stick
know,
to cooking.
Stick to cooking, and then he blocks them and says goodbye, you know, which...
He actually tries to answer them as much as he
sometimes,
can.
Sometimes, but he'll also flush them.
Yeah, well, it depends if they're wackos.
Anyway.
A legitimate question should certainly be fielded, and I would do the same.
But, so you just expressed a clear preference based on this agenda for one side of the aisle.
Absolutely.
Do you ever worry about that, or is it just
Well,
feel like
I think
luckily,
I think enough the people who sort of come for sustainable food, which is what we do, are on board.
Yeah,
on board.
Yeah.
I certainly don't mean to keep anyone out.
Yeah,
I would certainly welcome another argument. I'm sure that there are. Very smart Republicans with good views on the environment. They are not apparently powerful enough to make a difference
in
their party.
They're not setting the platform.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. So let's back up for 1 second. fishing.
Yeah.
There's a handful of pursuits that I've noticed a lot of chefs are into. Tennis. A lot of chefs play tennis.
Yeah.
Golf.
Yeah, golf is big.
Golf's big. Fishing is big.
Yeah.
At least on the East Coast. I don't hear it as much in California.
Michael Cimarruzzi, certainly.
Okay. But I mean, on the East Coast, there's you, Colicchio, Tom
Valenti,
Harold Dieterle.
Yeah.
There's a lot.
TJ Calapa.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
He has the Spaniard restaurant, for people who may not know PJ's name.
And Scampi.
And Scampi.
Yeah.
But what is it?
I think all the time I go out and you have not a great day on the water, or it's rough, or it's wet, or it's rainy, and I think, wow, is this really worth all the effort? Is this really... And then I think, what else would I do? What else could be close to, like... I mean, look at this.
Carrie's gesturing over the... Isn't this bad? What side of the boat?
That would be the port.
Over the port side of the boat.
So south into the harbor.
The sun is sparkling. We're sitting here at, what is it? It's about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We can see the Statue of Liberty, and the sun is shimmering on the Hudson River.
And it's pristine.
And we're actually docked.
Yeah.
Right, so.
I mean, there's
if you were pointing the other way, we'd be looking at park benches and bikers and, yeah.
But the water is in the best shape it's been in about 30 years, you know, due to the efforts of a lot of different groups. You know, you're looking at a cloud bank that's a remnants of a slight fog condition that happened this morning in Staten Island. I mean, just to be in any little boat and out there doing nothing, I mean, there's something that happens to people when they're on the water.
Well, see, this is the part that I instinctually would think is the appeal to someone who spends their time in the hectic environment of a kitchen. That
right.
That if you have the interest and need for something that would serve as relief to that or a counterpoint to that,
right.
It's hard to think of something much more opposite than going out in the middle of a whatever, lake, bay, I don't know.
Ocean,
dropping an anchor, sitting there with a line in the water and some beer. I mean, like, what could be more?
Well, for me, it is actually a lot more active than passive.
Is
what
it?
We're doing is what we normally are doing is we're looking for actively feeding fish. And
when you out?
Oh yeah.
Oh, this is like you don't. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, there's times when you what they call blind cast bait fish. Nothing's going on. You have kids on board or whatever. There's certain times when it's good for big predator fish.
Right.
But the exciting thing is to put all the pieces of the puzzle together and figure out with the wind and the tide, time of year, presence of bait, barometric pressure, any number of things.
Yeah.
This may or may not be a factor. You may use them as excuses or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's putting that puzzle together to find out, okay, this species should be exhibiting this behavior in this place at this time. And then you go, and hopefully you're right, or you use other cues to find the fish. Often it's birds that are feeding on bait that's been driven to the surface. That is, in of itself, extremely rewarding. Tom and I usually go fly fishing in salt water, which is challenging at, you know, way to catch a fish.
Mm.
You don't have the advantage of a spinning rod and the distance and the weight and all these things that would make it a lot easier. But again, it's more rewarding. You're tying the flies. You're creating. It's actually a recipe, is the word they use for a fly, to put the components together and tie it to imitate various bait fish or shrimp.
Is that right?
It's called a recipe. Yeah.
It's like a little kebab on the end of the.
Well, you're making it look like a little tiny minnow or a shrimp or something. But yeah, that's right.
That's hilarious. I never knew that.
Yeah. And so there's a certain level of pride and satisfaction when you write that recipe and execute it and put it in the right place at the right time. So it's a number of things that have to come together. I mean, as chefs, you have to have the time to do it.
Yeah.
You have to have, when that time occurs, you're hoping that the weather is right.
Right.
And then that all these things that you've predicted in terms of, presence of bait and predator fish and wind direction all do happen. So I always tell people there's like, the thing about fishing that is so different than other pursuits is that you are hopefully the recipient of something much bigger than yourself.
you don't have control over this. So there's a sense of being...
There's a zen.
A zen, a participant of nature and, yeah. and something... You know, when you look at the ocean alive with bait or fish and see whales and dolphins, yeah. I mean, it's... I hate to say it, there's a sense of wonder.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really an immense fortune to be able to participate in that.
Yeah.
And those are the rare moments, but they're the ones you remember, and they're the ones that keep you coming back. There's the crappy times when the fishing's no good, or the weather is crap,
or
the opportunities presenting themselves, and you know, like that easy overhead in tennis, you just blew it, you know, and you're like, that was my ultimate opportunity. Yeah. So, and the other thing is that you learn, because you're either curious or bored, about baits, about algae, about birds, about marine vegetation, all these things that you just sort of casually become a student of because you're out there so much.
How long an education, all this stuff that you're rattling off right now very confidently, how long an education has this been for you so far?
30 years.
You've been learning about this kind of stuff for that long?
Wow.
And who teaches you these things?
You just... you observe, you know, recall, you try and process. Well, you know, I saw, is that a heron or a crane or an egret? You know, and then, because you're not catching fish at that moment and you have the time to look at that bird. And then you go back and you look it up or you have someone, you know, a mentor. Often the guides you fish with know all these things and you travel and you fish in, you know, places like the bayous of Louisiana. Yeah. Often the Florida Keys is a great place to learn all these things. Even offshore, I fished in Miami, and you know there's amazing fishing right there.
My hometown.
Yeah, in your hometown. That many people would overlook.
Yeah.
Under the lights of you know the Fisher Island mansions, there are tarpon and snook rolling. And if you hit it right, you can catch them, you know, even in the winter on the right night with the right tide. Yeah. And it's kind of magic to be able to explore that and then come back to the bustle of South Beach, you know, and you fished from, say, 9 to 1 in the morning and everyone is all like jazzed up and you're jazzed up in your own way. Like a four-leaf clover, shining like a penny bright, landing on a four-feet.
My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
100 Bogart has made much progress over the past year since their grand opening. They are a growing community of professional freelancers, entrepreneurs, and startups. Their dedicated team guarantees you receive a productive and worry-free work environment. 100 Bogart is currently filling up their 2-person to 12-person private offices. The spacious pop-up gallery, premier rooftop, and brand new full floor with terrace are available for your next event. Podcast rooms, conference rooms, and meeting spaces are also available for booking. 100 Bogart hosts events like art exhibitions, pop-up stores, product launches, and fashion shows. Heritage Radio Network is a proud member of the 100 Bogart community and often holds events in the building. Visit 100bogart.com to schedule a tour and learn more. So make a list of all your
inclinations, 'cause you know she's gonna swing. Welcome back to the show. I'm going to get you right back to the rest of our interview with Chef Carrie Heffernan in just a moment. I do want to just remind everybody, if you'll indulge me, that my book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, How Food Lovers, Free Spirits, Misfits, and Wanderers Created a New American Profession, the story of the American chefs of the 1970s and 1980s, is available everywhere. Books are sold online and in person. And I dare say, if you have a food or chef fascinated person in your life, it would make a good holiday gift or a good use of the Amazon gift card somebody might have given you, if that describes you. Also, as always, if you would be kind enough to subscribe to this show, it is free on Stitcher or iTunes. That is the best way to keep up with the show. And you can also follow us, as always, at Chef Podcast is our handle on Instagram. We do post every time a new episode drops, and you can link to it from our Instagram feed. And with that, I'm now going to return you to the rest of our interview with Chef Carrie Heffernan, recorded in October in New York City. I hope you enjoy the rest of it.
Let's reel back a little bit to your arc as a chef. Mm. Where was your first gig as a chef in your own right?
So Alfred, I guess, gave me, you know, the chef de cuisine job at 1/5.
This is Alfred Portale.
Alfred Portale.
And 1/5 Avenue was a seafood restaurant.
Yep.
It was the only ever real offshoot of the Gotham. And it was where Otto Pizzeria is now.
That's right.
Yeah.
John Shank took it over as Clementine for a while.
Yeah, Clementine.
So that was the first shot. After that, I don't know if I went directly to the Polo. I guess it was at the Westbury Hotel.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, that was a huge departure, given that it's a union and we had, you know, a restaurant and room service and banquets and
fun.
All that stuff. Fun. But it had such hallowed bones. I mean, you know, think of the guys who'd gone through there.
Yeah, well, people won't know. Go ahead.
Well, Daniel Boulud was, you know, maybe the most. Thomas Keller worked under Daniel.
He was his chef.
Yeah.
Portale
Alfred
was
there.
Saucier.
Frank Crispo was there.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of other guys that don't come to mind. But it was like, there's a famous picture, and there's a dozen serious New York chefs who are the subordinates of Daniel, who was also the subordinate of... another French chef whose name escapes me now. Daniel was the chef de cuisine. He wasn't originally the chef of the
Polo. I don't think I knew that.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I'll have to fix that in the paperback version. So when you start taking your own gigs, right, it's interesting that your first one was specializing in seafood, given where you've ended up. But what did you... You know, I feel like when somebody stops working for other people and starts, you know, doing their own menus, to me, I've always found a kinship with the writing process. You know, I feel like that you're, you know, as a line cook and a sous chef, you're kind of starting to get a sense of your own voice.
Absolutely.
And what you're about. I always say it's like, what's your voice on the plate? That's how I think about it. When you kind of, even to this day, like as you've evolved, like, can you define what you do, what your style is, or do you just do what you do?
I'd like to think so, but then using the writer's gift to describe that might be more difficult.
Yeah.
But I think to your point, I always approach anything so that it has a point of view. Mm. Like if it's a dish, just doing it the way that it's wonderful or pleasant is not really enough. I think you have to give it at least a small point of view to say that it is otherwise.
But what does that mean in a dish?
So let's take linguine with clam sauce.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is actually something that I make because we have an abundance of hard shell clams, and I get to go clamming in Sag Harbor.
Yeah.
In front of the house. Any day of the year, there's no ice out there. And even times when there's ice, I'll trudge through the ice and get it because that's what cabin fever will do.
Yeah.
In any case, so there's a dish where, like, okay, you've got these great clams. You've got the notion of wonderful pasta. I'm lucky enough that I can grow all the garlic that I ever need and keep that. And there is probably 90% of what you would expect in a dish. And so how would you distinguish that? What would be your signature? Well, one for me is the use and the way that you'd cook the clams,
mm-hmm.
which may or may not be evident on the plate, but it's something that cooks would sort of...
You know it's there.
Right. And other cooks are always like, whoa, when you show them, you know, how to treat a clam. I think a clam is the absolute undervalued bivalve in the Northeast. It is so... I mean, I learned from David Boulay that clam juice is what he used to use instead of fish stock.
Uh-huh.
And there is, like, you know, a little light went off. There is an element, there is a building block that I, you know, use to this day. So the further way I would distinguish a dish like that is in using an herb that I'm, again, lucky enough to be able to grow myself, lovage. And it's a very short... Well, it's a spring and a fall thing. Kind of gets, it's too hot in the summer, it just dies off, then it comes back in the fall. So we've got it now, we have it in the spring. But lovage is this just, I think, very special, intensely celeried, you know, parsley kind of herb that people just don't have a chance to get very much of. So when you show them how it can sort of play in these very basic elements.
Yeah,
it's kind of a revelation. I think it's in finding those, you know, that dynamic relationship in a few ingredients, which is so right. hard.
And it's interesting to me that I'm not arguing with you, but that you express that as a point of view. Because to me, that's your style.
Okay.
Does that mean the same thing or different things?
Yeah, it does. But I think that
To me, that's your arrangement of the song.
Yes, absolutely. That's just the way I've always thought of it.
You think of it as point of view.
Yeah, I think addition of a point of view. Like you look at it, it should, whether it's mine or yours or anyone else's, whoever created that dish should hopefully leave it with a particular point of view.
Now, do you agree with me that whether or not the diner can know exactly what that was in your head is almost irrelevant?
Yes, I agree.
They can eat it, love it, not...
They shouldn't...
Not overly analyze it, but just know it was a little different from any other version they had.
That's right.
And that's enough.
100%. Yeah. They should not have to understand the cerebral process you went through to discover that dish. If they'd like to learn about it, great. Or if they get it because they're perceptive or curious or you know, very into it, and oh, well, I see where he did this and that and the other thing. Like Mozart.
right.
Didacting the Salieri entrance theme. But they don't have to. And I think that's kind of the problem that we went through. And I'd say we're a little over it, but the overly cerebral food of, say, 5 to 10 years ago, when it was just, it was about, you know, understanding this massive mental process and how tricky something could be. Wow. You know? And I love Jose Andres, and I would never say anything bad about him. But I did have, you know,
I'm
about to, because I think we went to Bazaar in Los Angeles, and he would pair his tasting menu with like traditional kind of Spanish tapas, and then these kind of, you know, modernist view.
Yeah,
and he did, and the one that I like to tear apart is the tomatoes and mozzarella, where he'd make the mozzarella into little globules, you know, spheres.
Yeah.
And from a point of view, the only reason to do that is if you could make it as good or better than the original.
Yes.
But only to do it so that you can have this playful, wow, look what I did, is a disservice to the diner and really to you as a chef. It's punching below your weight. You know, it's like...
You know, it's funny. Our mutual friend, Jimmy Bradley, who had the Red Cat restaurant, you know, he used to have this thing, we called it the Jimi Hendrix Principle, and it was about All Along the Watchtower.
One of the greatest songs ever.
Right. It's a cover of a Bob Dylan song, and Dylan said that's the way it was meant to be played when he heard it, right?
Wow.
But the point was, there's no reason to do a cover of a song unless you're going to do better than the original.
Right.
Because what's the point?
Right.
You're kind of saying that. You know, it's funny, and I mean, you just had this huge qualifier about what you said about Jose, but years ago in the Time Warner Center, I think it's maybe where Porter House is now?
Uh-huh.
I can't remember, but there was John George.
Steakhouse, yeah.
Had a place called V Steakhouse.
Yeah.
Now, I never ate there, but I remember reading the New York Times review of it, and there was a dish on the menu. It was a shrimp cocktail, but it was a soup. It was like a spicy tomato soup, and it had shrimp in it. And I thought, like when I took film classes back when I was in college, I had a friend who was a teaching assistant. And I remember once he said, there's certain movies you should only make if you're from the country that the movie's about, or you'll miss it, right? And I just remember when that dish was in that review, I thought, he doesn't understand. There's no one in the entirety of the United States that wants to walk into a place with the word steakhouse in its name, order something called shrimp cocktail, and not get the martini glass with the sauce, with the poached, cooled shrimp hanging off. That's what you want.
Right.
And you can, to your point, you can overly intellectualize these things, and it takes the fun out of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, there was a phase like that. Although it's funny, I feel like we're at a stage right now. You know, I've been doing all these book events, and I get asked these questions, and I've been asked, like, what do you see happening in the future in the industry? And I have been saying, I just said this in Chicago last week, I think we're going to have different categories of chefs. Like, I don't think the vocabulary has caught up to reality, right? And what I mean by that is, like, when you were coming up, the way you got to where you wanted to be was very, it was almost the same for everybody, more or less.
Right. It was a very clear trajectory.
You went to the culinary school, probably. You worked for a European chef, either here or overseas. Then you started working your way up the food chain. You started developing your own style, and then you got your break, right?
And that was 10 years.
And that was a long process, right. Now, that fits into the point I'm about to make. I feel like now things are very much stratified. You know, you have people who still are functioning the way you did when you were a kid, who are putting in those years, who want to know everything, right? Who want to master all the techniques and are happy to be sous chefs and whatever else for years. Then I feel like you have people who are in a mad dash to get their first restaurant open. I also feel like you have people who, and this may upset some older listeners, okay? But I've come around to this. You may have, well, you and I are both tennis fans, right?
Right.
There are, in tennis, there's what's known as a surface specialist, like a clay court specialist.
Right.
Okay. I think we're going to start seeing some version of that in cooking because you now have people who have a food truck. You may have somebody who just does steak sandwiches and does them really well, right? That person may be going on television shows and promoting themselves on their website and whatever else as Chef So-and-so, right?
Right.
Even though they probably don't have and probably don't need the same degree of training as a sous chef at 11 Madison Park.
No, not even close.
Right. Am I making sense?
Absolutely.
I think the vocabulary hasn't caught up to the reality.
Right, so the word chef.
I think maybe the word chef will still mean someone who's the chef of a team in a conventional restaurant.
Right.
And there's going to maybe be other words to define some. And I'm not putting anybody down.
No, I agree, and I think it would do them a service. I think it would be a good thing because it would help qualify them, and they wouldn't feel like they're, I hate to use the word faking it, but they're not, like you said, the guy who may have an extraordinary food truck, and he may have come up with these four or five things that are really great and work.
Yeah, they might be perfect.
They could and should be perfect, and he should be recognized for that. But to use the term chef and sort of, you know, equate that to people who have done, shall we say, a very different path.
Well, and who manage a team.
Yes.
Yeah.
And do a very different job.
Yeah.
Is really not fair to either one of them.
Well, the other thing I think is it is. This is another thing that's come up a lot on the road. You know, there's a lot of restaurant openings. There's a lot of restaurant closings,
yes.
Right? Now, I had this epiphany doing these Q&As on the road, which is the reason there are so many restaurants right now, it's not supply and demand. There are so many restaurants because there's so many people who want to be in the restaurant business.
Right.
And I think for all those people to find a place, ultimately, people are going to have to be creative. Like, for some people, a food truck will be the answer. For some people, a breakfast-only restaurant will be the answer. For some people, an entire career as a pop-up chef will be the answer.
Right.
Someone will be a traveling roadshow. I mean, people will have to move to smaller cities, you know?
Agreed.
And I think, anyway, I'm kind of going off on what you said, but I do think that's another piece of the puzzle. You know, I think that's a transformation that's already really happened, but we haven't recognized it.
I agree, and I think it would be better for everyone were that to be recognized and codified as such.
Yeah.
I think it would be a good thing.
Talk to me about what you do here. How has your, you know, when I first ate here, you know, we're on a boat. This is not unlike certain restaurants in Miami where I grew up. You know, where it's like, you know, fish fries and fish tacos.
Right.
And, in terms of setting, right?
An expectation.
But no surprise given your pedigree, but I remember being just knocked out by the effort that was being made here to what it seemed to me to be really over-deliver on what you need to do at a place with this kind of scenery and this kind of setting.
Well, I think people deserve it, and I think that, you know, everything else is maybe taking advantage of the setting and so I don't think it's maybe
other places like this
are maybe under delivering, and maybe they could do
step
a little better
right.
yeah
in 2018
right exactly.
But what's your kind of process here? How did you go about applying what you had to the kind of food one would want to eat sitting on a boat harborside in New York City?
Well, you have to fully understand that it's a lot of reverse engineering because there are, we do surprisingly massive volume on a weekend.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we might do 600 covers on 80 seats and 15 bar positions. Yeah.
Wow.
Now, that's 11 to 11. That's 12 hours.
Yeah.
But, and the kitchen, if you want to call that, is a galley that has 100 amps of power at its disposal.
Now, this, okay, this is a hole in my industry knowledge. Compare that to a,
so a toaster, an average size restaurant kitchen. A toaster at your home takes 18 amps.
Okay.
So imagine an industrial toaster and all these things. So we have to be extremely mindful of how we deploy that power.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, luckily what people want to eat is largely cold.
Yes.
At the same time, you've got to offer a diversity to keep, you know, people coming back.
Yes.
So storage is an issue.
Yeah.
It's a boat.
Yeah.
It's not that big to begin with.
Yes.
And it's shaped in a very incongruous way to, like, every single piece is custom. The walk-ins are not walk-ins you could buy. We create them. The ice machines are cooled by seawater. The, you know, storage is in, I use the analogy, in the 70s, we had a Volkswagen van that we would go to Cape Cod in.
Yeah.
And my mom would get the four of us, a dog, two cats, and enough stuff for the whole month into that Volkswagen bus. If you needed a toothbrush in Rhode Island, you were fucked. But it got in there.
Yeah.
And that's the way the weekends are here.
Yeah.
Like, you can get it in, but you've got to be very... It's a Jenga. You've got to put it in just so to be able to get what you need when you need it or without moving everything around.
I mean,
so,
I, what you're describing, I liken to, like someone's first studio apartment in New York.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, in terms of what you do.
And how you do it.
Yeah, any available wall gets a shelf mounted. The little area under your stove, which is supposed to be the broiler, is storage for pots and pans.
Exactly.
Like all that, right?
Right,
it's
right.
The
to
same
do
mindset.
This, you've got to move, you know, the bathtub might be full of, you know, your, the toaster oven when it's not, whatever it is.
Right.
Yeah, it's a little crazy. So, reverse.
Do you enjoy that part of it?
You know, there,
is it a badge
there's,
of honor there's to have a, solved it?
I think so, but it's like you look at anyone else who operates in a conventional kitchen with space and abundant power, and you're like, and that's it? That's all you could do?
Yeah, right.
So every single thing that you do is a learning experience. And I found that, no surprise, people grow the most when they're challenged the most.
Yeah.
So as stupid as reality TV cooking shows are, a month on Top Chef taught me a lot.
Yeah.
Because I had to go places I never had to, you know, before.
Yes.
You're not forced to deal with all the variables and the curveballs that get thrown at you and deliver at an extraordinary level.
Yes.
You know, and an extraordinary level beyond the guy next to you.
Yes. It's funny. Actually, the show that's dropping today is with Joe Flam, the executive chef of Spiaggia, who won season 15 of the regular Top Chef. You were
oh,
on
wow.
Master. You were
yeah.
on Master. But he made a very similar point. That going through that kind of trial by fire, though, to be tested that way regularly, even though in some ways it doesn't seem to relate to reality, it has real value.
It has a huge value. I mean, the other thing that I did, you know, was to do this. We did this TV show where we went to Panama, and we were in extremely remote conditions, and we had very ambitious ideas about. You've seen the trailer, right?
Yeah.
About cooking and fishing and being in extremely remote places. And that was a massive challenge. And I had to reinvent everything that I thought I knew just to get to, like, a base level to be able to sear a piece of tuna because I had to build the fire and make the pan level and get herbs from, you know, the Aboriginal peoples that were around me to sort of baste it with, because that was the vision I had.
Yeah.
And this is on no sleep and having caught the fish yourself.
Yes.
You know, 30 miles offshore in a boat that had absolutely no electronics. And if any one thing had gone wrong, I wouldn't be here right now.
Now, let me ask you a question. You gave your age away early in the show. This kind of thing you're describing right now.
Right.
You see, I mean, we've played tennis together.
Yeah.
You're pretty fit. Is it harder than it used to be, or do you feel like you've taken care of yourself in a way that you don't really feel it physically?
Oh, I absolutely feel it physically.
But that's the challenge, is that now you know that you have to stretch and you have to train.
I'm
and
just
you
laughing because of the expression you had when I asked that. Like, you looked like I was crazy.
No, it is certain. And as you well know, without the proper preparation and cool down, that you're just going to regret it and it's not going to be fun anymore. And you have to be careful. You got to be, you know, like what Eberhard Müller used to say, you know, work smarter, not harder, you know?
Yeah.
You have to be a little more intelligent about the way you deploy what resources you have.
Right. Okay. What is, this probably won't air until later in the fall because I have a bit of a backlog. What does your off season look like?
So the off season.
What does your winter look like?
So the off season is really involved in because there's no time to develop new recipes. There's no time to train people. There's no time to, you know,
when
create.
The places are up and running.
Yeah. It's because there's no room in the kitchens and it's just like full bore.
Right.
So a lot of that happens. Honestly, we do a lot of repairs. I mean, the boat takes a massive toll. It's a 90-year-old rotting piece of wood that happens to float this week, you know, and it takes a lot of care and effort to put that back. So does the kitchen, and we have to, you know, refurbish and refit everything. So these are things that I learned that you walk into a kitchen in a hotel, and there's an engineer that you call if it doesn't work, and then you expect everything is going, and you walk out. This is different. We also have the restaurant in New Orleans, you know, which is a great winter's, you know, it's not like it's tropical. It's not Florida, South Florida, but, you know, it's definitely nicer.
Yeah.
And then there's all this the sustainable seafood awareness. You know, I'm going to Los Angeles next week to do something called Digital Hollywood, you know, big conference, and that's going to be on sustainability. Later in the month, I'll go to Portland with Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch
A
Blue Ribbon Council of Chefs. Yeah. So I'm going to sort of figure out what other people across the country are doing and seeing how I can help contribute. I'll go to Washington, D.C. and lobby, you know, various politicians to sort of get. There's a very important bill in front of the Senate in the next 3 weeks, or maybe it's in November, that is really a big deal. It's something called the reauthorization of the Magnuson-Stevens Act. And the Magnuson-Stevens Act is what governs all of our fisheries. And the reason that America basically has the most sustainable and the best regulated fisheries in the world is this framework of laws. And there are people in a certain party who would like to just gut that because it helps a few of their constituents, you know, to catch a few more fish in the very short term. And, you know, if you want to talk about, like, not being careful of your as a steward of your environment, talk to the cod fishermen in New England.
Yeah.
Massive boats out of work. They got nothing to do and nowhere to go.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just they thought they knew more than the scientists and that they could, you know, scrape the bottom until you know, it would just continue to replenish, and it didn't. Now it's slowly coming back, and there have been some great byproducts of the lack of cod fishing. Scallops and lobster, for example, are in great abundance because of it. But this lobbying is an ugly, long, slow process, and it takes time. Creating awareness with not only politicians, but within consumers, within other chefs. You know, we created a coalition to stop serving striped bass on the menu because at one time striped bass was abundant, but now it is definitely not.
Yeah.
And it takes time for people to sort of catch up to ideas. So, you know, local and sustainable were two things that did apply to striped bass 7 years ago.
Yep.
They don't now. And I have to sort of re-educate people. And it's a lot of work. It's a pain in the ass, you know, stay on top of a population of fish. I was fishing with my son on Sunday, and my six-year-old, who just loves to fish out of nowhere. We caught false albacore, which was our intended target. But within it, we caught blue runners. I did not know what to tell him when I saw this. You know what a blue runner is?
No,
it's a tropical.
Did you say false albacore?
False albacore, yeah.
What's that?
So that's it's called an Ethotunis aluretus. It's a.
Is that white tuna?
It is not a true albacore.
Okay.
So it is a small member of the tuna family. It is quite gamey and strong. It's served as bonito in Japanese restaurants.
Okay, fine.
But they're extraordinarily fun to catch. They blitz on the surface. They go 40 miles an hour. They're the most beautiful things you've ever seen. And it is just absolute mayhem to catch them.
Uh-huh.
Within them were these blue runners. Blue runners are a tropical fish. Yeah. In Florida, they'd be common. In the Bahamas, they're all over the place. So to have blue runners on the inside of Montauk, in October.
Yeah.
I couldn't explain to him that I've never seen that in my lifetime. And that these animals are moving. They don't recognize politics or state lines. They know, you know, they follow the conditions that nature gave them. So here they are.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to explain to him, they shouldn't be here, really.
Yes.
I shouldn't have to give you this, but that's what's changed. That's what we're up against.
Yeah. So before we stop, I just have to say, you and I have tennis in common. And you and I also have that we kind of took it up as adults in common.
I've been playing for 6 years. I mean, how long?
I started earlier than that, but I didn't really get serious until I was in my 30s.
I got serious in my 50s.
No, but you are very devoted. Like you and I don't play that often, but every maybe twice a year.
Yeah.
And every time I get on a court with you, I'm struck by how you really are working hard.
I'm trying. I want, you know, it's the kind of thing that you can tell you to get passionate about, and it's a sport that, you know, you hopefully can play into your 80s. I see these guys out there.
It's amazing.
You know, playing doubles, and it blows my mind that they get to still have this much fun, and I want to do that too.
Yeah. How often do you play?
About once a week.
That's it. And you've made it. Wow. Well, I'm just telling people. Terry is markedly improved every time we play. All right. Well, this has been great.
Thank you, sir.
Coming on. I don't want to embarrass you, but. You know, I have this old line. Martin Mull used to say that.
Wow, there's a blast in the past. Yeah.
Old stand-up comic. Yeah. But he used to say Hollywood is like high school with money. And I've always said the restaurant business is like Hollywood with a little less money.
Yes.
There's a lot of politics. There's a lot of grudges. There's a lot of cliques.
A lot of clamoring for the camera.
You are universally seen as a good guy.
Well, that's nice to hear.
I've never heard a bad word about Kerry Heffernan.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
So. And thank those that said such nice things.
When I see them, I'll pass it on. Anyway, thanks for doing this.
Cheers.
And that's our show for this week. Kerry Heffernan, thank you very much for a fun interview and for what, for me, was a great one to revisit at this crazy time of year. I really did find it relaxing to listen back to that during the holiday season. Vitor, our engineer, thank you so much for doing double duty this season. A reminder, we are at the Brooklyn Podcast Festival on January 12th, 2019 at 2 p.m. Tom Colicchio is our headliner guest, and we will also be interviewing a trio of Brooklyn chefs, Greg Backstrom, Alex Raj, and Alan Harding. You can find the link to purchase tickets and get more information on our Instagram feed, or visit my blog, toqueland.com/appearances, and you can click through from there. All of you out there in podcast land, thank you for listening, and we'll see you back here in just a few days as we wind down the season on Andrew Talks to Chefs.